Hey everyone, welcome to this brand new episode of Forensic Tales. I'm your host, Courtney, and this week's story is actually a case that was submitted by one of our Forensic Tales listeners, Ariel. And in case you guys didn't know, you can submit a case on our website, forensictales.com, for a chance to have the story featured in one of our weekly episodes. So this week's story is one that you might have never heard of. It's a case that involved not just one serial killer, but two. These two monsters were responsible for terrorizing the city of Los Angeles between October 1977 and February 1978, killing 12 innocent women throughout the sunny California Southland. The two killers abducted, tortured, and strangled their victims. Their bodies were often left on hillsides surrounding the crowded city of Los Angeles. Forensic evidence eventually tied the two serial killers to the murders and started what became the longest criminal trial in California's history. This is the story of the Hillside Strangler. On October 17, 1977, the body of a completely nude young female was discovered on a hillside near the Ventura Freeway in Southern California. Responding officers of the Los Angeles Police Department immediately could tell that the body had been wiped down and was left squeaky clean before being dumped on the Los Angeles hillside. Police officers also noticed faint ligature marks around the victim's neck, wrists, and ankles. Ligature marks like this tell police that the victim in this case was most likely strangled and bound by rope. In addition to being strangled, after the body was transported to the coroner's office, medical examiners were able to determine that the victim had also been brutally raped by her attacker. After the autopsy was complete, the victim was identified as 19-year-old Yolanda Washington. Although Yolanda listed her occupation as a waitress at a local IHOP restaurant, she was actually known around town as a sex worker in the Los Angeles area. A few weeks later, on November 1st, 1977, police were called to Alta Terrace Drive, a neighborhood only about 12 miles from downtown Los Angeles. Police were responding to a call of another nude, deceased body of a young female found along a hillside. The young victim, who appeared to police as being a very young teenager, was found naked, face up on a parkway in a middle-class residential area of Los Angeles. Her body was actually discovered by the homeowner of the property, who had the wherewithal to cover her nude body with a tarp to prevent neighborhood children from seeing her on their way to school that morning. Just like what investigators saw with Yolanda Washington, police discovered ligature marks around the second victim's neck, wrists, and ankles, indicating that the young girl must have been strangled and bound. It was pretty obvious to responding officers that the body had been killed somewhere else and dumped on the property, mostly because of the location of the dump site. It was literally, you guys, on someone's property. And it's super unlikely that someone would be able to commit this type of brutal murder along this hillside without being seen. Investigators also observed a small piece of light-colored fluff on the victim's eyelid. Now, we know that in any and every piece of forensic evidence is extremely important in cases like this, in all cases for that matter. So forensic experts collected the fluff in hopes that it could reveal an important detail about the murderer and who her savage killer might be. The body was transported to the medical examiner's office for an autopsy. When it was determined that the victim had been raped and sodomized before her death, the victim appeared to be very young, and she only weighed 90 pounds at the time of her murder. Police originally thought that the victim was most likely about 16 years old based on her appearance, but she was actually properly identified as being only 15-year-old Judith Miller, who was a local runaway with ties to being a sex worker near downtown Los Angeles. Judith Miller was last seen on Halloween, October 31st, 1977, talking to a man driving a two-tone sedan on Sunset Boulevard in the city of Los Angeles. Now, this is the late 1970s. There has to be literally thousands and thousands of two-toned sedans driving around downtown LA. But this information provided police just a little bit of information regarding Judith's last known whereabouts. Only 6 days later, on November 6th, 1977, another naked body of a young woman was discovered near the Chevy Chase Country Club in the city of Glendale. Like the two earlier victims, the body had obvious signs of ligature marks around her neck, her wrists, and her ankles. There were also obvious signs that the female victim had been raped before her body was dumped. The woman was identified by medical examiners as 21-year-old Alyssa Kasten, or Lissa as she was known. Unlike the first two victims, Lissa was not a sex worker, and she didn't have any ties to prostitution. She actually worked as a professional dancer for the LA Knockers. So this told police that they weren't just looking for someone who only targeted sex workers. Like we saw in the case of the Green River Killer, a story that we covered in episode 3, but it told police that the killer was targeting any and every young girl throughout Los Angeles. At this point, within just a few short weeks, police had discovered the body of three young girls who all appeared to have been killed in a very similar manner. All three girls were strangled with rope, raped, and their nude bodies were dumped along different hillsides throughout Los Angeles. The similarities in each case were way too obvious for police to ignore. They knew they were looking for a serial killer, and they knew that if they didn't catch him quickly, there would be yet another victim found alongside a Southern California hillside. In early November 1977, two men who identified themselves as LAPD officers approached 24-year-old Catherine Lorbaker, who actually happens to be the daughter of famous Hollywood actor Peter Lorre. The two officers asked for Catherine's wallet, and upon searching it, the men saw a picture of Catherine sitting on her father's famous lap. The two men handed Catherine back her wallet and just simply walked away. Now, it's not clear why the two men left at this point and left Catherine without incident, but my best assumption here is that when the men saw the photo in her wallet, realized who she was, and they just decided that it's best not to mess with a famous celebrity's daughter. But then again, that's simply speculation and has never been confirmed. On Sunday, November 20th, 1977, the bodies of two young girls were found by a 9-year-old boy who had been out on a hillside near Dodger Stadium hunting for treasure. How traumatic it must have been for this young, innocent 9-year-old boy to come across the badly decomposed bodies of two girls, I can't even begin to imagine. The two girls were identified as 12-year-old Dolly Cepeda and 12-year-old Sanja Johnson. Both girls were last seen a few days earlier on November 13th, in which both girls were boarding a bus heading home. The girls were last seen getting off a bus on York Boulevard and Avenue 46, approaching a two-toned sedan. Now, if you recall, reports also indicate that the earlier victim, Judith Miller, was also last seen getting into a two-toned sedan. But again, how many two-toned sedans are there throughout the massive city of Los Angeles during the 1970s? Both Dolly and Sanja were savagely raped and murdered, and their bodies were dumped near Dodger Stadium. That same exact day, on November 20th, hikers came across the naked body of 20-year-old Christina Weckler, an honors student at the Art Center College of Design. Christina was described as being, quote, a loving and serious young woman who should have had a bright future ahead of her, end quote. Her body was discovered on a hillside between Glendale and Eagle Rock. Again, similar to our earlier victims, investigators saw obvious ligature marks around her neck, wrists, and ankles. But upon further examination of her body, police saw a very strange and very unusual mark on one of her arms. Police saw two puncture marks on her arm, which typically resembles needle or track marks that are often seen on the arms of drug users. But Christina wasn't a drug user. She had absolutely no history of ever using drugs. During Christina's autopsy, the medical examiner examined the two puncture marks on her arm, and it was determined that she had actually been injected by the common household cleaner Windex. Yes, Windex. Why Christina was injected with Windex, police and the public will never know. It's now believed that this may have been some form of torture before she was brutally murdered. Only 3 days later, on November 23rd, 28-year-old Evelyn King was discovered near the Los Feliz off-ramp off the Golden State Freeway. Evelyn went missing on November 9th, and her badly decomposed body was discovered a few weeks later. Because Evelyn's body had been exposed to the elements for such a long time, medical examiners were unable to determine if she, like the earlier victims, had been raped or tortured before she was murdered. After Evelyn's body was discovered, the Los Angeles Police Department established a 30-officer task force to try and catch this savage killer, who is now nicknamed the Hillside Strangler. But police and investigators didn't believe that they were just searching for one serial killer. Because the victims had been murdered and their bodies dumped elsewhere, police believed that they were actually searching for at least two killers. They believed it was very unlikely that one man working by himself would be able to abduct, torture, rape, murder, and then dump the victim's body along the hillsides. The only thing scarier than searching for one crazed serial killer is searching for two. The bodies of three more victims were found between November 29th, 1977, and February 17th, 1978. The victims included 18-year-old business student Lauren Wagner, 17-year-old sex worker Kimberly Martin, and 20-year-old student Cindy Lee Hubstaff. All three victims showed signs of strangulation and torture before their murders, In all three cases were believed to have been committed by the Hillside Strangler. The MO, or modus operandi, of the Hillside Strangler is pretty consistent. The killer or killers target young females of various backgrounds, not just local sex workers or runaways. The stranglers abduct their victims, torture them, often raping them, and strangling them to death. Their bodies are dumped at separate locations, often a hillside throughout the city of Los Angeles. The MO is to rape and kill the victim in a separate location and then dump their bodies elsewhere. The killer or killers leave behind very little forensic evidence because they oftentimes clean up and wipe down the bodies extensively. It's pretty clear to me that this killer or killers aren't necessarily motivated by sex. Rape and torture aren't typically seen as sexual crimes. They're actually more of a sign of a crime of power. This offender wants to control these women, and most likely they want to control them because they have this deep hatred towards all women. They see women as inferior to men. And by raping and torturing them in this way, they are exhibiting control and power over their victim. It's not about sex or sexual desires. It's about power. By January 1979, police finally make the arrest in the case of the Hillside Strangler. Police arrest Kenneth Bianchi and his cousin, Angelo Bono Jr. So let's back up in our story, and let's talk about who these two monsters really are. Kenneth Bianchi is originally from Rochester, New York, and decided to move out to Los Angeles, California, to live with his older cousin, Angelo. Both men were total losers. But Kenneth actually looked up to his older cousin, Angelo, and really saw him as this successful older guy that he himself wanted to be. The two cousins decide to live together in Los Angeles, California, after several failed relationships with both men. When the cousins start to run low on cash, because again, they're total losers and neither one of them want to actually work jobs, they decide to get a couple young girls to work for them as prostitutes. Two teenage runaways, Sabra Hanan and her friend, Becky Spears, meet Kenneth and Angelo and move in with them. I'm assuming that at first, these two girls were in need of a place to stay, and most likely, Kenneth and Angelo tricked these girls into believing that they were getting into something else entirely. But the two girls start working as sex workers, while Kenneth and Angelo literally take every dime of earnings from the girls. Luckily, the two girls were able to get in contact with a local attorney who actually arranged for both girls to escape from Kenneth and Angelo. Kenneth and Angelo again become short on cash and realize they need to find more teenage girls to work for them as sex workers. Impersonating police officers, Kenneth and Angelo found yet another young girl and moved her into their home. Kenneth and Angelo actually bought a trick list, which, full disclosure, you guys, I had absolutely no idea what was meant when I read this while researching this case, but a trick list is basically a list of names of men who frequent prostitutes. A young girl by the name of Deborah Noble and her friend, Yolanda Washington, delivered the trick list to Angelo in October 1977. Now, if you recall, the very first victim believed to have been killed by the Hillside Strangler was local sex worker Yolanda Washington. So police believe shortly after receiving the trick list from Yolanda Washington and her friend Deborah Knoll, Yolanda was brutally murdered by Kenneth and Angelo. This tells police that Yolanda Washington was specifically targeted by Kenneth and Angelo. The last known murder and 10th victim of the Hillside Strangler was in February 1978. During this time, Kenneth and Angelo were no longer getting along. Even when it comes to abducting and torturing women, the pair just stopped seeing eye to eye. Kenneth Bianchi decided to leave Los Angeles and move up to the state of Washington. He even started applying for a job with the Bellingham Police Department, which is equal parts amusing as it is terrifying, that a crazed serial killer would even attempt or try to become a trusted police officer. Now, thank God, whoever was in charge of hiring for the police department decided that Kenneth just wasn't a good fit for the department. So Kenneth Bianchi decided to become a security guard instead. Again, his choice to want to become a police officer or a security guard really speaks to this guy's ultimate desire to be in a position of power and control. While working as a security guard, Kenneth Bianchi just couldn't control his urge and his desire to kill. Completely on his own, without the assistance of his cousin, Kenneth was arrested in Washington by the Bellingham Police Department, the same police department that he tried to become a police officer with, for raping and murdering two college students he lured to a home for a house-sitting job. At this time, police finally charge Kenneth Bianchi and Angelo Bono for the 10 murders on the hillsides throughout Los Angeles. After their arrest for the murders, Kenneth Bianchi eventually claimed an insanity defense. Kenneth claimed that he suffered from a dissociative identity disorder and that a personality separate from his true self was actually responsible for all the murders. Kenneth told the judge in his trial that the murders were committed by Steve, one of his alternate personalities. So under any due process, the court is pretty much obligated to look into any insanity defenses raised by the defense. So the court ordered a forensic psychiatrist to visit Kenneth in jail and meet with him regarding his claim of this personality disorder. After examining Kenneth in jail, the forensic psychiatrist immediately picked up on the fact that Kenneth was basically lying about his personality disorder and he could completely made it up. Once Kenneth Bianchi realized that his made-up personality disorder wasn't going to fly in court, he suddenly changed his mind. He came forward to the court and confessed to the Hillside murders. One of the biggest reasons why he decided to come forward and confess was to be able to testify against his cousin and avoid the death penalty in Washington for the murder of the two college girls. Law enforcement and prosecutors piled a ton of physical and forensic evidence against both Kenneth Bianchi and Angelo Bono, proving that combined, they were in fact the suspects behind the Hillside stranglings. Law enforcement found jewelry in Kenneth Bianchi's home that perfectly matched the description of jewelry worn by two of the victims, Kimberly Martin's necklace and Yolanda Washington's turquoise ring. Now, you guys, it's super common for serial killers to hold on to personal possessions from their victims. It's often like a trophy for the killers to hold on and remember their victims by. In addition to the personal trophies, police also found hair and fiber evidence that directly linked some of the Hillside murders to Kenneth Bianchi. And remember that small piece of light-covered fluff retrieved from 15-year-old Judith Miller's eyelid, the Hillside Strangler's second victim? Well, forensic scientists were able to determine that the little piece of fluff from the victim's eyelid was a perfect match for the kind of blindfold the killers would use in the attacks. But the forensic evidence in this case doesn't stop there. In case there was any doubt, Kenneth Bianchi and Angelo Bono are the monsters responsible for the Hillside murders. Crime scene investigators actually linked animal hairs stuck to one of Lauren Wagner's hands to bunny rabbits that Angelo was raising. Investigators also found the imprint of a police badge on Angelo's wallet that proved the two men impersonated being police officers in order to make contact with their victims. After hearing the prosecution present the overwhelming physical and forensic evidence against Angelo, presiding judge Ronald M. George ruled that there was more than sufficient evidence to show the presumption of guilt on behalf of Angelo. Although his cousin, Kenneth Bianchi, was prepared to testify against him, Angelo still insisted his case go to trial, and he still claimed his innocence in the murders. The first part of the trial was to determine whether or not to sever the non-murder counts, so like the charges of pimping and rape, from the murder counts. If the counts were separated at trial, the jury wouldn't necessarily hear about the unspeakably brutal treatment of Angelo against his victims. Judge George decided to sever the murder counts from the non-murder counts to avoid a reversal if the case were to be appealed. The judge also made his decision because he was certain that the prosecution was going to be able to demonstrate Angelo's character some other way during the trial. On July 6, 1981, Kenneth Bianchi took the stand at Angelo's murder trial with an attempt to convince the court that they couldn't use his testimony against Angelo after all. However, his unbelievable testimony and performance in court didn't sway the judge or the prosecution, and the charges were not dismissed against Angelo Bono. The trial and case against Angelo Bono went on and on and on, seemingly to no end. Over 250 witnesses were called, and literally thousands of exhibits were presented by both sides at trial. The case became the longest-running criminal trial in California's history. Angelo Bono was eventually found guilty of murdering Lauren Wagner, Judith Miller, Dolores Cepeda, Sonja Jackson, Kimberly Martin, Christina Weckler, Lissa Kasten, Jane King, and Cindy Hubspeth. He was not found guilty for the murder of Yolanda Washington. The jury debated on whether or not to sentence Angelo to the death penalty or to sentence him to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The jury ultimately decided to spare Angelo Bono's life and sentenced him to life in prison. Because Kenneth Bianchi pled guilty to the murders and didn't take his case to trial, he was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole. Angelo Bono died of a massive heart attack on September 21st, 2002, while serving his life sentence at a state prison in California. His accomplice and cousin, Kenneth Bianchi, is still serving his life sentence at the Washington State Penitentiary in Walla Walla. And side note on Kenneth, while he's been serving his prison sentence, he met a woman by the name of Veronica Compton. And I know what you're thinking, you guys. Here's another case of a woman falling madly in love with a guy in prison. But anyway, it happened. So Kenneth and Veronica officially got together. Well, sort of. They still had prison walls between them in 1980. Veronica Compton even testified in Kenneth Bianchi's defense in the trial. So this woman was dedicated to this guy. So while in prison, Kenneth and Veronica came up with this insane plan to try and prove that the Hillside Strangler was actually someone else entirely, and that Kenneth Bianchi was 100% innocent in the murders. Somehow, some way, Kenneth was actually able to get his sperm from within inside of the prison to Veronica on the outside. Don't ask me how this was possibly done or how it could have happened without prison guards knowing, but it did. So Veronica took the sperm and she met a young woman working as a sex worker where she lured her into a motel room. Once Veronica and the young woman were in the motel room, Veronica actually attempted to strangle the woman, and she left the sperm sample behind in this crazy attempt to make it look like the Hillside Strangler was someone else entirely. Because remember, how could Kenneth Bianchi actually be the Hillside Strangler if there was another victim when he was locked up in federal prison? Well, it doesn't take someone with a master's degree in forensic psychology to know that this is literally the worst plan in the entire world. The sperm sample belongs to Kenneth Bianchi. They literally took his DNA and placed it all over the crime scene. Like, seriously, how does that make any sense whatsoever? Well, it just doesn't. Luckily, the victim in this case survived, and Veronica Compton was convicted and sentenced for her role in the botched murder and was eventually released from prison in 2003. The story of the Hillside Strangler has been featured in a ton of movies, TV shows, and documentaries over the years. And I'm kind of surprised on actually how many movies and shows talked about this case, because I really didn't know much about this story before I started researching it for the show. Some of the media featuring the Hillside Strangler includes the uber-popular TV show Criminal Minds and has also been made into several made-for-TV movies. Of course, if you want to read more about the Hillside Strangler case and check out some photos from the story, go check out my website, ForensicTales.com. After each episode, each week, I post a blog about the case that features the show notes and pictures related to the case. And also, you guys, the case of the Hillside Strangler came from a suggestion from a Forensic Tales listener. So if there's a case out there that you would like to have featured on my show, go to ForensicTales.com and there is a form to suggest a case. I would love to hear from you and talk about your favorite case on the show. We release new episodes every Monday, so tune in next week to satisfy your true crime itch. Forensic Tales is a Rockefeller Audio production. Thank you so much for listening to this very special episode of the show. Don't forget to subscribe to Forensic Tales on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Also, don't forget, if you have 2 minutes to spare and love the show, please leave us a rating with a review. Your support means so much to me and the show. Join me next week where we discuss dogs and murder. Until then, you guys, remember, not all stories have happy endings.